You are listening to the cycling podcast A De Vuelta a España in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Kenyon's Run. Stage 12. Today we are in Bilbao.
Well, hello from Bilbao. I'm at the end of stage 12 of the Vuelta a España. It's finished here a couple of hours ago, and my name's Richard Moore, and I'm joined on the line by Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard. Hola.
Thought we'd bring you off the bench. Bring you off the bench tonight, Lionel.
Been limbering up.
Don't want you to get rusty sitting there.
Been limbering up for a couple of days. We're desperate to be involved yesterday when I heard about your two Michelin star meal. And then then laughing at you. Explain what happened.
Okay. So I would say a very misleading website for the hotel in question, because when I booked it, and Daniel made the same error, if you can call it that, it very clearly states all over their website is boasting talk of the Michelin two-star chef. And so, you know, much excitement. And I've been looking forward to this for weeks and weeks, because when I looked at the menu for the restaurant, it didn't look very expensive at all, which, with hindsight, should have struck me as a little bit odd. Anyway, we were looking forward to this all day yesterday. And as we finished recording the podcast and, you know, made for the restaurant, we sort of looked at the restaurant and its very bright lights and sort of, you know, one waiter shuffling around, and thought, this does not strike us as a one-star Michelin restaurant, never mind a two-star one. And embarrassingly, we actually asked the waiter about that, and he explained that the menu had been designed by a Michelin two-star chef who has a restaurant 30 kilometers away.
Wow, that's...
So what followed was a pretty average meal.
I saw you photographed a dish that looked to be just some cress or maybe some lamb's lettuce or something very small in the middle of a large plate.
That was a little bit mischievous, because that was actually about to be filled, that bowl, with some gazpacho, which was very nice, beetroot and tomato, which was nice. It was a perfectly pleasant meal, but it wasn't quite the treat or the occasion that I'd been looking forward to, but never mind. Enough about that.
My FOMO is subsiding, at least.
Well, subsiding rapidly, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's Pinchos on the menu tonight here in Bilbao. I'm going to go and meet somebody soon and go around a few bars, have a few Pinchos and a bit of chacoli wine, and that will be part of tomorrow's Kilometre Zero.
Oh.
But Lionel, there was a stage today. I didn't see much of it because I decided to get here to Bilbao early and get up the final climb of the day, which was sort of on the outskirts of Bilbao, or in the city itself, really. Just a brutally steep little climb. Great atmosphere up there. You know, lots of people, as you always get in the Basque Country, and it was so steep that riders would appear and take a good, you know, couple of minutes to actually go past you. So it was really great up there. But can you tell me, can you fill me on what happened in the stage?
Well, I can try, Richard. Yes, I watched it on the TV this afternoon. It was stage 12 from the motor racing circuit, the Circuito de Navarra, to Bilbao, as you say. I know this area reasonably well, because on my previous visits to the Vuelta, I've managed to be there for these sort of stages. The time trial a couple of years ago started at the motor racing circuit, didn't it, that Chris Froome won. And, it was aggressive racing, hard racing again, because it took almost 100 kilometres. In fact, I think it took more than 100 kilometres for the break to get clear. And it was a big group, 19 riders in it, some powerful names. Who was in there? Jose Joaquin Rojas of Movistar, Manuele Boaro of Astana, Heinrich Hauser of Bahrain Merida, Felix Grosschartner of Bora Hansgrohe, Philippe Gilbert, Tim de Klerk of De Koenig Quickstep were in there, Nikias Arndt of Sunweb, who's won a stage, of course, Trek Segafredo had John Degenkolb and Jacopo Mosca in there. Valerio Conti was in there, former stage winner, in Bilbao, I think, a couple of years ago. Is that right? Or very close by. And Alex Aranburu, who was a runner-up a few days ago. No, Conti won...
Well, yesterday.
Conti won the stage that finished in Urdax.
Oh, sorry.
A few years ago.
That's right, sorry.
And...
Did you just say Aranburu was... he finished second last week, didn't he? Of course, your last day at the...
He did, that's right. Yeah. And, well, they got away, and although the break wasn't, you know, it wasn't huge, it was enough to know that they were going to contest the win. There was a period of time where Grosschartner and Skabu Grame of Mitchelton Scott were away together. But the man of the day was Philippe Gilbert, who really rode very aggressively on the final climb and dropped everyone with about a kilometre and a half to go to the top, and then descended well and rode on the flat well to win his sixth Vuelta stage of his career, his 10th Grand Tour stage win. He held up both hands to symbolise or signal 10 Grand Tour stage wins. And Alex Aranburu got his second place a few seconds later. Not much GC action on the hill. Miguel Angel Lopez of Astana did have a go, but Roglic and Jumbo-Visma were very attentive. So Roglic, who really crushed people in the time trial yesterday, retains the red jersey. And tomorrow the stage finishes at Los Machucos, which is where Stefan Denifil won for Aqua Blue Sport, held off Alberto Contador in pretty remarkable fashion on the climb. And well, of course, Denifil has subsequently confessed to doping. But the climb itself is spectacular tomorrow. I'm sure you'll enjoy it when you get up there, Richard. But today, all about Philippe Gilbert. And he loves the Vuelta, doesn't he? Six stage wins there. He's won a couple in the same Vuelta on two occasions. He won the year... he won the world title, so just a few weeks before winning the world title. And then the following year, he won a stage in the rainbow jersey, which I think was his first victory wearing the rainbow bands. So there's something about the Vuelta and Philippe Gilbert. And maybe he's laid down a bit of a marker for the world championships in Yorkshire later this month.
And we haven't had it in yet, but our diarist, James Knox, is sharing a room with Philippe Gilbert. So we're hoping for some insight into Gilbert's win today from James when we get his diary later.
The fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Kenyon's Run.
Thank you very much indeed to our title sponsor, Rafa, and we will be presenting one of their wonderful Pedaleur de Charme t-shirts once again this week. Last week's winner was presented with his the other day, Angel Madrazo, who holds on to the King of the Mountains jersey still after today. But a few nominations trickling in for Pedaleur de Charme, including Clément Chevrier, who we'll hear from later in this episode. He's the AG2R rider who, one of two riders I omitted when I reeled off the names of the riders doing the Vuelta, who are alumni of Axel Merckx's development team, Hagens Berman Action. So I apologise to Clément and spoke to him, and we'll hear from him later on. But before...
Not bad, yeah, Richard, sorry. I mean, 80% accuracy on that, though. I thought that was good. And it was a really enjoyable episode as well, just hearing, you know, those guys really do sort of feel like they're a kind of a band of brothers, almost like they went to the same school or the same university. Which I suppose, in a way, they did.
Yeah, the whole subject of development teams is interesting because what I am curious about is what you can learn in a development team as opposed to being on a senior professional team. And I think it's interesting because you can learn how to lead a team, you can learn how to win, you can basically learn all the jobs that might be required of you as a professional, whereas if you're a young rider and you're not a Remco Evenepoel or a Tadej Pogacar or somebody like that, then you cannot, I think, find yourself, you know, doing the kind of the donkey work and sometimes get stuck in that role a little bit. So development teams are important, and you know, give riders an opportunity to do other things and learn other tricks and skills. So yeah, maybe a subject we'll return to. But Lionel, before we proceed with news from today's stage and the Vuelta, I mentioned last night that we were going to announce tonight the special guest who'll be joining us in Harrogate, and here is a clue.
Look, let's go to Matt White.
Look, the only, but look, for us, look, he's going to have, yeah, look, so it was, look, look, a stage like that, look, the Valverde group came within 10 seconds, and look, but look, I know what other teams' plans are as well. Look, I'd be concerned if he wasn't tired, and look, we've gained time.
And also, look, we didn't talk about it during the week. Look, we're definitely going to the Vuelta this year, and look, I would like him to go to the Tour de France next year, but look, it's part of a long-term plan we've had for Esteban.
Well, that wasn't so much a clue as a giveaway, was it there, Lionel? That was Matt White, of course, the Mitchelton Scott Sports Director. We've invited him to join us in the Royal Hall in Harrogate on Friday the 27th of September for the biggest show we'll ever have done. It'll be you, me, Francois Thomaso, Daniel Freib and Matt White. And one of the reasons we wanted to ask Matt back, and he's coming over specially to do this, was because he was in our event at the Arts Theatre in London a couple of years ago, and he was terrific value, wasn't he?
He was great fun. Yeah, he really got into the spirit of it and told some very revealing, enlightening, but also very amusing stories. So if you've already got a ticket for our event in Harrogate, you're in for a treat. If it wasn't good enough seeing Francois and Daniel, hey, Rich?
Well, absolutely. And, well, I mean, I mean, Matt White is very indiscreet in these situations, so we're hoping for more. But who can forget the story about the toilet roll and Tom Dumoulin at the Giro, which he revealed on in that show? So yeah, there's lots of great stuff. I mean, Daniel almost stormed off stage at that point. Of course, he couldn't really handle that sort of detail. But it was very, very entertaining. So we're delighted that Matt is joining us. And we've got a bit more Matt White in this episode, because although he's not here at the Vuelta, you, Lionel, spoke to him recently about last year's Vuelta, which they won, of course, with Simon Yates. And we thought it'd be great in one of our Vuelta episodes to hear Matt White's account of last year's Vuelta. So we'll hear that in the last part of tonight's episode.
If you want to get a ticket for our event in Harrogate, we've sold a lot of tickets already, so there'll be a big crowd. Don't worry, you won't be sort of just sat in the front row on your own. Lots of tickets sold, but still plenty more available. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com and click on live events, and you can buy a ticket for that event or any of our November events. Our Grand Tour runs from November the 11th to November the 30th, so check that out if you want to come along and see us do all this kind of stuff, but in real life.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great way of selling it, Lionel. Well, today, as you said earlier, all about Philippe Gilbert, really, today's stage, and, you know, a bit of a... I asked Daniel yesterday whether there were many more stages like yesterday, which were the main GC guys. I wouldn't say they had an easy day, but it wasn't a day where they really came out fighting. There was a little skirmish today, but it was another sort of phony war stage for them, wasn't it, really? Although these climbs are very, very tough, the race didn't really catch fire among the GC contenders. I say that as if, you know, I actually know what happened. I didn't see much of it, but this is what I'm gathering from, you know, reading about what happened and speaking to people about what happened. But notable as well today for the performances of the Pro Conti teams yet again. You know, Alex Aramburu, second on the stage, 23. I think he might be off to Astana, as I mentioned last night. He's obviously a talented climber. And Fernando Barcello of Euskadi Murias, who won, of course, yesterday. He was third on the stage. So those teams are really doing well. And, you know, you expect those riders to perform well in the Basque Country, where a lot of them are from. I mean, Carural are local too. So, yeah, very, very strong performances from them. That's been one of the features of this Vuelta, really. And I remember at the Giro, we spoke about, you know, how the Pro Conti teams there really underperformed, and here they're sort of overperforming. I wonder why that is. It might be worth looking into that a little bit.
I think one of the things that's been notable about this Vuelta is that the way the stages are and the way that the GC race is does lend itself to the breakaways having more success. I mean, when you think back to the Giro and particularly the Tour de France, you know, how difficult it can be for the breakaways to succeed, because partly there's so much incentive for the sprinters' teams to bring everything back together, partly because there's more sprinters. And partly, I think, just the way that the stages contain so much obvious but also hidden climbing, if you like. You know, it's not easy territory to control and keep everything together. I mean, in a parallel universe, you could have a sprint finish in Bilbao if they hadn't gone over that steep climb towards the finish. But because of that climb, the GC riders, I think psychologically, isn't there something slightly different? If it was all still on the line for the stage win, it might be less easy for Jumbo-Visma to control. And I think it just suits them to let everything get out of reach, early in the day. Or it took a long time to get clear today, but give themselves a relatively straightforward 60, 80, 100 kilometres into the finish without having to worry that, you know, maybe a little group will clip away. I mean, remember what happened back in Calpe at the start with the group going away and Quintana clipping off to win the stage. No one, it's not in anyone's interest really for that to happen. And so it narrows down the overall race to probably now, what, five stages starting tomorrow with Los Machucos. But just Philippe Gilbert and his longevity. He's signed a three-year contract with Lotto Soudal, which will take him to the age of 40, so clearly no sign of slowing down yet. And I mean, it was an absolutely classic Gilbert stage today, wasn't it? The climb suited him, the running suited him, and the way he raced it was it was vintage Philippe Gilbert.
Good at cycling, isn't he, Philippe Gilbert?
Not bad. I mean, he won Paris-Roubaix in April, so you know, normally the Paris-Roubaix winners are quite good at cycling. But yeah, he's done everything really, hasn't he? And like I say, he might have his eyes on a second rainbow jersey later on this month.
Absolutely. But yeah, it's that sort of insight that you know really should entice you along to one of our live shows, isn't it?
What, that Philippe Gilbert's good at cycling?
Yeah, we'll reveal a few more cyclists who are good at cycling during the show. Stand by for that.
Well, Primoz Roglic is quite good at cycling as well, isn't he? As he showed, he's very good at cycling on his own, as he showed in the time trial yesterday. And
it wasn't the time. The second time you said the time trial was yesterday. It was actually 2 days ago.
All the days merge into
time
one
flies.
when you're at home.
Time flies when you're enjoying yourself. Yeah.
Yeah, sorry about that, Rich. But it's all going to kick off again on Los Machucos tomorrow, I think. And, it'll be interesting to see who... I think Roglic will probably quite enjoy that climb. And it's just a case of whether or not the others can apply enough pressure to open up some gaps. It's not a classic mountain finish. It's it's wooded and twisty and turny and a very strange concretey surface. There's some sketchy descents on the way as well, and it could be very similar to the finish at Mas de la Costa, where the four of them broke away and really sized each other up.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour at the Tour de France, interrupting the Vuelta podcast to remind us to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Roca. Roca Sunglasses was founded in 2013 in a garage in Austin, Texas, with the mission to produce the world's finest eyewear. Every pair of Roca eyewear is unbelievably lightweight and will never slip or fall off your face. And they feature razor-sharp optics. And they're worn by Miguel Angel Lopez, who
and
is
Lionel
riding
Burney.
High on the GC. And me, yeah. Well, I was dubious about this claim that they wouldn't slip, but having been running in the Barton sunglasses, I can vouch for the fact that they don't move a millimetre. As far as I can tell, very comfortable to wear. But Richard, you made a claim a few days ago that you were going to purchase some Roka sunglasses for your brothers for Christmas, and I wondered whether you'd got round to that yet.
Yeah, I have actually, Lionel. I have to say that one person who sadly won't be endorsing the Roka sunglasses is Daniel Freeb, because they were among the items stolen from his car a few days ago.
Oh,
which
no.
Is, he's very, very sad about that. But yeah, he went for the Oslo sunglasses, which are pretty cool. They're a bit different to the sort of more wraparoundy ones. They've got sort of round frames or rounder frames, and maybe sit off the face a bit more. So they kind of make you look quite studious in a way. Daniel obviously wanting to look intelligent. I got a pair of those for one of my brothers. I thought he would really, really suit those. The Barton, the trustworthy Barton. I've got a pair of them as well, Lionel. I really like them. Got them from my other brother. And I got a pair of the Aviators as well. Just really pushing the boat out there. But the Aviators look pretty nice. I don't think I'd get away with...
Yeah, they do.
I don't get away with Aviators, yeah. I'll be honest. But I think one of my brothers will.
I don't think I'm quite cool enough for that style of frame. I do also really like the look of the Torino, which is quite out there as a frame shape, but I think they look good. But there's something for everyone, I would have thought, because there's men's frames, women's frames, and of course there's the whole range of glasses designed for cycling in, which is the core product, including the CP and GP series, which again I wasn't sure that I could carry them off, but they not only do they fit really well, but I think they look great. And very happy with my two pairs of Roka sunglasses, and thank you very much to Roka for sponsoring the cycling podcast through the Vuelta. And if you would like to check out their range, go to roka.com/Vuelta to get 20% off your order. That's roka.com/Vuelta, and Roka is spelled R-O-K-A.
Well, Lionel, I mentioned earlier that in the Kilometre Zero we released yesterday, called Axel's Alumni, all about Axel Merckx's development team, I had picked out 9 riders who had ridden for that and who are here at the Vuelta, but I missed out 2. Theo Gegenhardt, not so delicately, pointed out that I'd missed out Clément Chevrier. It was also pointed out by a couple of people, including Ben King, that we missed out Ruben Guerrero, who rides for Katusha Alpecin here, and he also spent a couple of years with, as it was then, Action Hagens Berman. So apologies to them, and I did manage to catch up with Clément Chevrier at the finish today. He's an interesting chap with an interest in wine as well. So here's what he said at the finish. Clément, I start with an apology for overlooking you in the alumni who are here from Axel Merckx's team. But you, I mean, quite unusually for a French rider on a French team, you spent a couple of years there.
Yeah, just 1 year actually, in 2014. I did 1 year here, just my last U23 year, and yes, I went. I turned pro just after that in IAM Cycling.
And what did you get out of it? Did you was it an experience that was important for you?
Yeah, it changed. Actually, it changed my life. I have to say, I did nice 3 years in France, and but I was like in. I had a small like burnout from the like of the French program, I have to say, and I had to see something totally different and something more fun, and just something totally different, and so I asked to Axel if he can help me to do that, and if I can ride with him, and so I was super happy to actually to finally I preferred. To be pro in the Axel's team than to be like in Continental Pro or World Tour for my last U23 year, because I knew that was a super good formation development team. So yeah, and it changed my life also. Like I met so many nice people in US. So I have just to say thank you to Axel for.
And knowing the US as you do, it's somebody for Larry Warbass to talk to.
Yes. And the good thing now, I can actually speak in English with so many guys in the peloton, and it's like the Axel's team is like a small community, like in the peloton, everyone. So it's nice over the years that you can keep just the ADN from the Axel team.
I'll let you go and get your shirt, but I want to ask you about wine because you're a wine connoisseur.
Yeah, also I have my my studies in like a Somme. So I have my own company also in wine tasting. So I do it next to cycling. It's my passion also, and my grandparents live in a wine region. So yes, I always kept university and studies next to cycling, and now I'm more focused on the wine. So that's nice.
Do you get to taste the local? Do we taste the local Basque? There's a famous Basque white wine, the Chacoly wine. Will you get to taste that tonight?
Yeah, no. I have to say, we in a Grand Tour, we saw where we go, but we can't taste. Actually, we are just focused on the race, I have to say. But the good thing is, the first, it's just to see the part, to see the area, and on the race day, for example, you can ask to someone to go in the wine shop to get a bottle, and few weeks after or few years later, you can say, oh, remember this stage, this. So yeah, that's pretty funny actually.
And what, how's your Vuelta going?
Pretty good actually for the team. We got a lot of top 10 now, but we missed the victory, and we have a nice leader here. I'm here to help him, to help the team to win a stage. So now we still trying every day in a breakaway, so we keep it like that. It's the best way to win a stage. So yeah, that's pretty good, but it's still so many races and so many stages to do well.
So that was Clément Chevrier, the young rider on AG2R, and interesting. I don't think many French riders have been on that team and spent time in the US. Quite an unusual path to take, but he, as he said there, feels like he benefited a lot from it. So, and has that network now of you know, English speaking colleagues who he can catch up with. So yeah, we'll follow him as well. And a nomination for him already for Pedler de Charme for week two. So he may well end up on the pole. Who knows? But Lionel. The it's gone now. There was a bit of noise there while I was speaking before we heard from Clément.
Yeah, I'm wondering where you are. Are you some kind of bottle smashing unit in Bilbao?
Yeah, it's where I like to hang out when I'm in Bilbao. I'm just outside a bar beside my hotel, actually, just around the corner from the finish. As soon as I finish here, I'm going to go and meet Enrico Garatti, who's somebody that I know from this area, who is a publisher, and he's published quite a few cycling books. So he's going to take me to a few bars, I hope, and we're going to eat some pinchos, and we're going to meet up with Daniel as well. So that's on the agenda tonight. We should hear from our diarist, shouldn't we? We've just had their diaries in, an ecstatic James Knox. Another good day for him individually as well as for the team. He moved up a couple of places on GC, so he's 18th now overall, and I think it looks like things are going in a positive direction for him. I think he's feeling better and better, so he can still pick off a few more ahead of him, but he'll be looking forward to the climbs, I'm sure. And Nick Schultz as well, who used to ride for Caja Rural, his teammate, his former teammates, right, Alex Aramburu, mentioned already, he was up there second today. So we asked Nick if he could tell us a little bit about him, and here they are now, James Knox and Nick Schultz.
Here we are, stage 12. Great day for the boys. What a day, fantastic. Just a mental day, really. We had it all today. 100k for the break to go. So many attacks in the start, crosswinds, some climbs, shit weather. All the boys in our team doing their best to try and cover moves. But really, really, looking at how much Phil, Stevie and Tim did was really amazing, you know, for 100k and still jumping on move after move after move. Amazing, and get two boys up the road. Look, sounds like they played it perfectly. What I've been hearing in the bus, Tim set up Phil, and it was vintage Gilbert getting away, taking the win, and it's going to be a nice celebration tonight. Whoa. Fantastic, really. My point of view, dead chuffed as well. It was a hard day actually, with 100k of all out attacking, trying to get in some moves there myself. For a second thought I was going to be with a few lads splinting the crosswinds. We had a nice little group at one point, but yeah, after that it was just all out racing. Managed to recoup, get myself in a good position for the climbs, and Lotto Visma really put on a display of force there, controlling it in the finale. Set a really tough tempo on the second to last, third to last climbs, even on the last one as well, and only an attack from Lopez. I got distance a bit at the bottom, but managed to come back, and then it was quite controlled by Soler in the final. So no, what a great day. Fast fans as well, brilliant. The atmosphere on that last climb was amazing. Coming across the line, full spectators out, really, really, really nice to see. It's great for the morale. It's a special place for cycling here. So great to be in the Basque Country. Great to get a little bit lucky with the weather. It looked like it was gonna absolutely hoof it down at one point, but we only had a bit of rain, a bit of drizzle, didn't get too cold. Hoping we can continue like this, you know, seem to be able to keep following the good guys. And who knows what's possible. But most importantly, got the stage win, another stage win. So yeah, brilliant day.
Well, stage 12. I anticipated the hard start, but honestly I didn't think it would take that long for the breakaway to go. 110 kilometers it took. I'd say that's the longest I've ever experienced for a breakaway to go. Personally, I was trying to get in it myself a lot today. A few of us from the team were trying a lot, as you needed a lot of numbers if you were going to make that move, and we eventually did, with Scavu getting up there again and having a great ride. I knew some of the roads at the start of the stage today, having spent a little bit of time around the area in Pamplona, and also they were similar roads to Grand Prix Miguel Indurain, which goes on to the circuit that we started at today. But honestly, I didn't know it too much, just sort of familiar. In the finale there, it was also pretty tough, and I think only the locals really would have known it. One of those locals, Alex Aramburu, who is an ex-teammate of mine, was up there again in the breakaway. I think he's been up the road many times and had a podium result on a stage already. He's an absolute hitter, really big talent, and I think we'll be seeing him in the World Tour next year. And he's it's merited, massively merited. He's super strong, but probably his biggest asset is his racecraft. He's really, really smart on the bike. Knows how to sniff out a move, and in a finale, he's got a really good gallop to go with his climbing ability as well. So he's an all rounder, and he's a great guy as well. Local Basque rider. And yeah, the Basque guys are generally always really friendly and really passionate about cycling in particular. Tomorrow, it's a very hard day, a lot of mountains, and we finish on the brutal climb. That's essentially just like a boat ramp for 7K. It's concrete slabs, so steep that they need grooves in the road to give cars and essentially us grip as well. So it'll be another brutal day. Cheers.
Well, another evening to celebrate for De Koenig Quickstep and James Knox. I mean, he must be learning a lot sharing a room with Philippe Gilbert. Well, you know, seeing just how he races up close, and you know, what he's like, how he gets through the Grand Tours off the bike as well. It must be quite a privilege, really, to learn from somebody who's been there and done it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure he's taking full advantage of that. Even the way that Gilbert obviously targets stages, you know, how does he do that? How does he prepare differently? You know, what's his kind of game plan? I mean, today, Tim de Klerk was a really valuable asset to have in that move. And you know, it was a stage where the really hard climbs came right towards the end, and Tim de Klerk was there pretty late on, actually, for such a big guy. He rode pretty well over those climbs, and he's somebody who's so selfless. You know, he'd have been there purely to help Gilbert, and he's the ultimate sort of domestique, and a very important guy for him today. It was actually one of the Trek Segafredo riders who was up there, Mosca, you mentioned earlier. He also did a power of work in that move, and noticed that during the stage he was Trek Segafredo sent out a press release saying he'd just agreed a 2-year contract extension. It was almost as if that was a reward for his work in getting into the breakaway today.
Are you sure he didn't?
It was kind of strange timing.
He didn't drop back to the team car just to put pen to paper.
Well, I didn't notice.
No,
that.
I don't think
it's possible.
I don't think he did do that. I'd imagine that was. I'd imagine that was already lined up. Not sure.
You think? I
mean,
I would think so.
Deals are done in funny ways.
Yeah, Jacopo, if you can get in the break today, we'll give you 2 more years. How about that? I heard another, just before we move on, Lionel, another funny little thing I read today. I saw on Twitter, Sam Bennett had tweeted that actually, but they're calling him the Irish backstop.
Oh, very good.
Because he's often last man on the climbs, and he was pretty close to being last man today, although Tony Martin was quite a bit behind him today. He was last man today. He was a good four or five minutes behind the last group, the Gruppetto Tony Martin. Obviously had done a lot of work earlier on, but yeah, he got a big cheer up the climb, as you'd imagine.
This podcast is a Brexit-free zone, though, Richard. A little oasis of calm away from the chaos.
I actually don't know what's more exciting at the moment, Lionel, the Vuelta or that.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
So my name's Ian Stannard from Team Ineos, and my favourite Science and Sport product would have to be the Rocket Fuel. It's full of fructose, tastes great, and gives me all the energy I need in a classic.
Thank you once again to Science and Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast, the finest sports nutrition products you can get, and you can get them for 25% off at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. So do take advantage of that to stock up on your sports nutrition products from Science and Sport. Now, Lionel, what have we got in this third part, as if I don't know?
Well, we're going to hear from Matt White, the sports director at Mitchelton Scott. He was one of the sports directors at the Vuelta last year, which Simon Yates, of course, won. Julian Dean was the other sports director, I think is the lead sports director on the race for Mitchelton Scott this year. But I asked him during the Tour de France, actually, if he could just run through a kind of... How do you win the Vuelta after the disappointment of Simon Yates' late collapse at the Giro d'Italia in May? They came back stronger, and they put together a really smart campaign. So I wanted to ask Matt White to talk us through how they did it. Firstly, let's go back to August the 25th, 2018, the first day of the Vuelta. How were you feeling? You'd already been the team sports director through the whole Giro and the whole tour. Were you still feeling fit, raring to go?
Yeah, look, it was. I wasn't on the whole Vuelta last year. I was there for 75% of it, but we were very motivated because we knew we had very exciting prospect on our hands, and that was the ability to win the Vuelta with Simon Yates.
What had been the kind of debrief like since the Giro? I know everyone was going on about what caused that collapse in the last few days. How did you ensure that it wouldn't happen again?
Yeah, I think we as a team, maybe we backtracked to the Giro. Maybe the tactics that I had at the Giro may be a little bit too aggressive, and that came and bit us in the tail end. But we had a mentality going into the race that because we didn't know where Simon's time trialling was, and we knew with Dumoulin and with Froome there that we had to take time whenever we could to get that buffer for the time trials, which we knew we'd lose time. We just didn't know how much. That was one thing. Other thing, you've got to get everything right with your hydration and your nutrition and those things over 3 weeks. So we learned some things last year's Giro as well. Obviously, the Vuelta is probably even more important because it's the hottest of the three Grand Tours. So we made a big effort with our bottle points and our hydration and pre and post cooling exercises. But then I suppose our plan was different for the Vuelta as well, because we knew by the time we got to the Vuelta where his time trialing was, and obviously a different field as well. So we had a different tactic at the Vuelta, and it certainly paid dividends.
So what was that tactic?
Just to be a bit more conservative at times, because especially when you look at the first week of the Vuelta last year, it was in the south of Spain, so incredibly hot temperatures, and you pay for those efforts somewhere along the line. So we rode a very conservative style, especially in that first week of racing, and you didn't see too much of Simon until he got to the middle of the race, where the temperatures were cooler and the terrain suited him more.
What did you think of the level of opposition there at the Vuelta? Because, I mean, it was a pretty stellar top 10 when you think Thibaut Pinot was seventh in that race.
Yeah, look, it was, but the world is always it's a tricky one, because some guys are preparing specifically for it. They do the Giro and the World Cup as a program, and some guys have go to the World Cup because they've made a mistake at the Tour, or haven't achieved something at the Tour, or they've crashed somewhere else. So you get a different variety of field there, and also guys with I look at different ambitions as well, different ambitions and different. Not levels of commitment, but you know, at the end of the season, some guys are a little bit tired. Unless they've had a clear break after in that middle of the year, the Vuelta, if you specialise in the Vuelta, I think it's a big advantage.
There was that first mountainish stage just above Granada. Mm. That was a hot day and a tricky climb, and Simon just kind of nestled in the wheels a bit that day. But then La Covertila, the last stage before the rest day, was where he took the red jersey, and the suggestion at the time was, is this too early? Is this a sort of variation on the Giro again?
Internally, we didn't want the jersey in the first week, that's for sure, but we were confident in the team we had there that we were going to be able to control that race. And I think as a team, we've grown a lot over the last 3 years, and we've led all three Grand Tours. And nearly won a couple as well. So we're confident in the group we had there that we'll be able to hold it to the finish.
So did they sit down on the rest day and think, let's see about how we could maybe let the jersey go out? Because Jesus Herrada took the jersey for Cofidis for a few days, didn't he?
Yeah, we did. And that was the decision that obviously Julian Dean made, and it was a great one. Yeah, because, you know, we didn't need to keep the jersey. If it came to us, it came to us. But we had the team to hold on to it. But sometimes there's some games to be played between teams as well, and we forced other people into chasing, and we saved our energy for when we thought it was going to be more valuable.
So you were there 75% of the time. I know you were there at the start and then at the finish. What was it like, the days off you had?
I came home because the race was actually close to my home. So I went home for a few days, and I obviously had a big, busy year travel-wise, and popped home for a bit, saw the family, and then back off to the world. I was watching everything and talking to Julian in the car. So he was ringing me in the stage, because sometimes, obviously, in the car, television's not 100% reliable. So he'd just pick up the phone, and I'd be telling him what I see on television.
Well, what was your impression of the other riders in that race? Miguel Angel Lopez is always dangerous and aggressive. The final week, what was the thinking?
Always movie star are a threat wherever they go, because of the style of racing. But I think with those guys, they just weren't at the level that they were used to. And I can't remember. Some had ridden the Tour, and the combination wasn't working for them. And obviously, if you haven't got legs, you haven't got legs. But they're always a worry. And same with the Astana. That aggressive style in the mountains, of putting blokes up the guys up the road and then getting across to them, that was always a threat, and that was a threat even on to the last mountain stage in Andorra. So we were confident, but obviously very cautious, especially of those two teams.
With the last stage being, or the last significant stage being, more or less on his home roads, because he lives in Andorra, doesn't he? I mean, was there anything you could sort of tell him about that day? Did he know the road really well?
Oh, the whole team knew the road. I think the vast majority of our guys have residence in Andorra, so it was like training on local roads for those guys. So they knew every descent, they knew every village, and they'd reconned it in training camp before. So it was a big advantage, because it's in that situation with that much pressure, knowing
the descents, knowing you could take risks here, you didn't have to take risks there, it was an advantage on that day.
What is the pressure like at the Vuelta? Because obviously the Vuelta, I mean, it's only been held in the late summer slot for 20 years. It feels like quite a young race in some ways. What is the atmosphere like, the pressure like? Does it differ from the other two?
Totally. It's definitely the most relaxed of the three Grand Tours, and coincides with the Spanish culture, I think. We get in northern Spain. They're pretty hardcore cycling fans anywhere near the Basque region or northern Spain in general. And then, you know, some of those stages in the middle of Spain, there's nothing much in between towns. So it doesn't feel like, it's a very different pressure. And it's a lot more relaxed for the riders and staff.
But in terms of having the jersey, and as the days tick down and you've still got the jersey, was there any of that doubt of, well, we know what happened at the Giro, we've got to just hold our nerve here?
I certainly didn't. I certainly didn't, and nor did Julian. I think we were very confident in the group we had there, and against the rivals we were going up against, and you know, we were very confident that we could hold on. And we had a plan there also, obviously, to bring in Adam Yates into form in that last three days. And when we saw him starting to reach his best, that was obviously an incredibly encouraging sign to have him. And you know, he only played factor on 2 days of the race. But one of them saved us. You know, we were under a lot of pressure at that stage in Andorra, and Adam's ride that day really was a big impact of had a big impact of Simon's victory.
Yeah, because you mentioned the rest of the team; they were all in an unfamiliar position as well, weren't they? Some fairly inexperienced guys having to do an experienced guy's job.
We had basically three separate teams last year, and I think it shows that we've got depth. And I think people react, or you act either way under pressure. People either step up or they fail. And sometimes it's good to put people under that pressure so to see what they're really like. And if you keep using the same guys in every Giro and every Tour or every Vuelta, well then, yeah, you can rely on them, but you're also not developing the next wave of athletes coming through.
So what was the atmosphere like when you knew that this was going to be the first Grand Tour on the board?
Yeah, it was incredible. And to have Jerry and his wife to come from Australia to see the last week of the race, it was... He's not a normal sponsor. We have a different respect for Jerry because he's shown a lot of faith in us, and we love returning the favour.
And what was the party like in Madrid?
It was good, as you can imagine. In Spain, everything went pretty late. Pretty late. Well, I think the race didn't finish until dark, which was nearly 10 o'clock. Then we stayed, because obviously we waited for Simon there for his control and presentation and media, and then Oil's wives and girlfriends, and we were having a few beers, and we had to go out to the airport, which was near where we were staying, and then we had quite a late dinner, not late Spanish style, but then we sat down for dinner at like 11:30 at night, and then a few of the boys kicked on to the official Vuelta party after that. But it was a good one.
And from your point of view, I mean, was it pretty seamless as Grand Tours go?
It was. I don't recall any crashes or punctures at inopportune times. It did go quite smooth. It's always, especially, I think our biggest concern was probably that first week, just how all the boys would react to the heat. I suppose that would be a general concern for everyone, because it was, for the south of Spain, it's pretty extreme temperatures. And, you know, we know it like a Tour Down Under, if you make mistakes with your hydration or pre and post cooling, it'll hurt you. And the difference between Adelaide at 40 degrees, it's a 1 week race, not three.
Well, that was Matt White on the Vuelta last year, and remember, you can come and see him with us at the Royal Hall in Harrogate on Friday the 27th of September. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com live events and you'll see all the live events that we've got coming up there, and we hope to see as many of you as possible. I better go and get my pinchos, Lionel. But before I do, some thank yous to friends of the podcast. Very grateful to you for your support. Sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. And among those who have, and a big thanks to James Gilroy, Alex Stevens, Michael Kramer, Michael Mutri, Benjamin Anderson, Joe Cox, and Lindsay McCrae.
And a big thank you to John Nelms, Robert Duffy, Jason Comer, Stuart Duckworth, Adelaine Burafa, and Anina Diston. And Richard, are you going to explain what, for those who don't know, what pinchos is?
Well, they're like small tapas, sort of smaller versions of tapas that are often laid out on the bars in bars, and you help yourself, and then you
keep your cocktail sticks and pay for however many you've eaten at the end. I read the other day about why they're called pinchos, but I can't remember. You caught me off guard there, Lionel. But yeah, they're small tapas.
So tapas,
and they're sort of particular to the Basque country.
Tapas is already small meals, so pinchos are small meals.
Yeah, and the beauty of that is that you can eat even more of them. So,
well, although is there a sense of shame when you hand over 42 cocktail sticks at the end, or is that just fine?
that's absolutely fine. Actually, I read on the internet that they're also popular in La Rioja, Cantabria, Asturias, and Navarra. So the regions neighbouring the Basque country, but I think they're particularly sort of identified with the Basque country, so...
When you get across to Oviedo in a couple of days' time, don't forget to try the cloudy cider. I'm not a big fan, but they make a big deal of it over in Asturias.
Oh well, that's a great recommendation. Well,
I mean, you've got to try it. They pour it from a height to aerate it, which I don't think does much for it. But I'd like a second opinion.
I know what you mean. Yeah, and yeah, they do the same with the white wine here, which makes it slightly fizzy, which is really nice. So they serve it in glass tumblers and pour it from way up high. So a lot of it gets spilled, but that's just part of the charm. Anyway, I better go, Lionel, because these pinchos are not going to eat themselves. So thank you very much for joining me tonight.
A pleasure. Enjoy your pinchos.